When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of All Too Real 2. My name is Michael E. Cullen II, and with me, as always, is...
Decimi Cream Incarta.
Okay. I'm gonna say this is the most offensive name you've had yet.
Is it? Why?
I don't know, it just is.
I mean, I'm sure they can make cream out of sesame, I don't know, but it seems like good. I don't know. I mean, I'm no chef, but...
Are you sure?
I don't know, maybe.
I am.
Why not? No. Sesame oil. They make sesame oil, don't they? Yeah. Maybe you could turn it into like a cream. I don't know. Maybe not. Yeah. And all I do know is that you got the right one, baby.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So, I got to tell you something.
Sure.
So, the other day, even though I've been sick at home with COVID, I somehow traveled to Chicago.
Yeah.
I joined a gang.
Really? That fast?
Yeah. I got right off the train or bus or plane or however I got there. Car, foot, bike, you know, some form of transportation that took me to the magical land of Chicago.
Yeah.
The land where you're there for a few minutes and all of a sudden you're in a gang.
Yeah. It's just part of the process.
And not just any gang, like a gang that wears bandanas and fedoras and shit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's when you know they mean business.
The weird armband that you twist over your arm or a tourniquet or something or whatever.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's when you're in a real gang, you know.
And you doubly know you're in a real gang if they call themselves the Blades.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know you're in.
Yeah. I mean, I was in this gang called the Blades. And, yeah. Then they started telling me that I needed to buy some ice skates.
Yeah.
And I got really confused. And then I realized I joined a hockey team and not a gang.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then you had to start delivering papers called the Blade. You're like, what the hell?
Yeah. And all of a sudden I was in Toledo and I don't know what the hell's going on. So this may have been a COVID dream.
It could have been. Or it could have been a dream from watching the greatest movie of all time, The Buttercream Gang. Circa 1992, 93? I don't remember.
92, I believe. Yes. Yes, 1992. Yeah, so 1992. Good year for film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Malcolm X, I think, came out in 1992. I think so.
Yeah, Batman Returns, Lethal Weapon 3, Sister Act, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Great time for film.
Of course, it was Lost in Chicago. He would have joined the game, so...
Yeah, that's a good thing you didn't go to Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
If I've learned anything, you don't go to Chicago. Ever.
Just don't.
No.
Especially from a small town of good Christians like Elk Ridge, which we don't know what state it's in.
No.
They never said.
Yes. So, anyways, in the past, we have covered the sequel to this cinematic masterpiece, Buttercream Gang in... The Secret of Treasure Mountain or something. Is that right?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And that was a very enjoyable, probably one of the greatest films ever made.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure why it's not on the AFI 100 list of greatest films in, made in America ever. But, you know, I keep hoping every year that they, you know, every time they release a new 100 list, you know.
You know what might help that is if they make a whole bunch of unsolicited phone calls to millions of people and to get the word out, and then maybe then they'll get put on one of those lists, you know?
Like a do not call list.
Sure.
That you're supposed to listen to. And
yeah. Fun trivia about the company who made this movie, by the way, is that they got into a bunch of lawsuits, both from the government and what was it? I don't remember now, but for basically doing a telemarketing scam.
In 2009, the Feature Films for Families and the Dove Foundation together paid $70,000 to Missouri's Merchandising Practices and Revolving Fund after using the Dove Foundation to solicit on behalf of the for-profit 4Fs. Basically, so there was like this do not call law at the time where if you were on that list, the only people that could call you were charities, you know, like legit charities and unscrupulous charities, whatever, you know. So you could be a good charity or you could be like, I don't know, Donald Trump creating a charity or some bullshit. I don't know. They were calling all of these people. So like in 2010, Verizon Wireless, for example, filed a lawsuit against them, alleging that after they allegedly placed 500,000 illegal automated telemarketing calls in just 10 days on the Verizon mobile phone network to try to advertise their upcoming feature film, The Velveteen Rabbit. And then later on, they got in trouble. Basically, in the end, their owner in a related suit, their owner, who is Forrest S. Baker III, very fancy name. And he had two additional companies, one named the Corporation for Character, LC, and Family Films of Utah. So he was waging deceptive and illegal telemarketing campaigns, pitching movies, and soliciting for donations, including more than 16 million phone numbers on the Do Not Call registry. Yeah, and they called over 2 million of those numbers in only 2 weeks. Yeah, and they used fake caller ID names like Customer SVC, Family Values CB, and Velveteen. They weren't being too creative there.
No,
but yeah, they basically were claiming that all of the proceeds for this fundraiser would help them finish up creating this recommended viewing list to help parents and grandparents like us with a list we can trust. So basically, I've figured out how I'm funding my next movie, and
yeah, calling 15 million people, they got like a little automated message and a weird, you know, handle. And there you go. You're cooking with gas there. Speaking of cooking with gas, this movie is definitely cooking something.
I felt like I inhaled some gas when I watched it.
Yeah, maybe nitrates for me, but because it made me feel good. But yeah, good Christian wholesome company, you know, here. You know,
yes.
This movie, the values of this movie definitely do not correlate with the values of the company that made it. So I've
never heard of this ever happening in history where a like Christian espousing company or like, let's say, religion or a pastor or somebody, you know, says something one day and then does the exact opposite, you know. Later.
Oh, no, never.
Wait, not like another day, but later that day.
No, of course not. And they're all wholesome and everything about, yeah, I know, but.
Yeah, anyways.
I love this movie. Love it so much.
Yeah, what's your history with this movie?
And so, my friends growing up there, you know, neighbors that lived down the street, they were very religious. They actually belonged to a church that practiced the Sabbath on Saturday. It wasn't the Seventh Day Adventist. It was a different church. It was called Worldwide Church of God back then, and they've changed the name several times since then. They got various splinter groups. There's only about 50,000 members in the world, I think.
No.
It was pretty small, so you know they really weren't allowed to watch like too much like secular entertainment. But MASH, they were for some reason. MASH was a big thing there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, every day they watched MASH when they did reruns, and also Walker Texas Ranger on Saturday nights. That was allowed. We would come over Saturday night sometimes. We'd watch Walker, and it was just. But they also had the Buttercream Game. That was like one of the only movies that they had on VHS, and we watched it at their house one time. I loved it. I thought it was great. And my friend didn't really like it that much, so he let me borrow it for like 2 years, and I just watched it like 20, 30 times from like the age of like 9 to maybe 12, I think. I mean, then I kind of got, you know, sick of it after that or whatever. So this movie has like a really special place in my heart because you know, it's kind of like the opposite for me. Like, I was not really raised religious at all or anything like that. So that was like the first, like, quote-unquote religious movie I'd ever seen that was kind of like a, yeah, well, it's not really religious, but it's kind of like got the underpinning, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's got like a religious message without beating you over the head with it, but beating you over the head with the message, but not necessarily the religious part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. I mean, there's a lot of people, like, especially like Christian people, because there's like some kind of like organizations and stuff that would like, they would link up with like churches and other places I've read online where they would, this, you know, the four Fs. And they had some kind of like almost like a Columbia House sort of thing with them where you would join and they would send you like a religious movie every so, or a good hearted movie on there that they released like every so often. Like if you paid for it, it was some kind of like subscription thing. I don't know if they had like the whole like, you know, spend a penny and you get like a bunch of movies and then you have to buy like five later, but it was something, it was some kind of subscription thing early on. And a lot of churches and schools would like sign up for that thing and then do that. And I was reading one thing where this guy was talking about the movie and he said that they had copies of it. They sent it home over the weekend with the kids with a like a booklet or something, trying to convince their parents to buy the movie and join this club. Yeah. But if you didn't buy the movie, you had to return the VHS or whatever. So,
of course, yeah. Wow.
I mean, this is the time. I mean, I'm sure they do similar things now because they have like those stupid candy bars that they sell all the time and stuff. But, you know, this is the time when you'd have these. We had these things called kits, which were like a big, like, cardboard suitcase looking thing that you opened up, and it's got like samples of all these different things that were like, you know, pencil toppers and keychains and bullshit like that that you had to go door to door and try to sell.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Good times, you know. Making kids capitalists early on to raise money for your school, especially when you went because I went to a private school, so that's why. But yeah. So I guess the tuition that they were paying wasn't enough. Anyway, so this movie, what happens in this movie?
Okay, so what happens in this movie is probably the most harrowing tale, morality tale, in any movie in history so far. And it's a stark reminder of the dichotomy of man, okay? So there's this character named Pete. His name is Pete Turner. He is the oldest member of a gang called the Buttercream Gang, and which... the members of which are called Buttercreamers and creamers.
I used to belong to a gang when I was a kid. We were called the Strawberry Jammers.
Yeah,
Strawberry Jam Gang. I mean, and then we called ourselves Jammers.
So. Yeah. And then you got in trouble because they thought you were like jamming like signals and stuff like that. Well, that would kind of make sense with the whole thing with the four Fs here. But
yeah.
So Pete Turner, he's like the oldest, and he has to move to Chicago to help look after his aunt's two children because she's divorced or something. I don't know what happened. And so he nominates Scott, which is one of the members, to be the president. And he goes up to Chicago and he's, you know, doing good in school. He's, you know, a good example to his nieces or nephews. I'm not sure the genders of them. And then he writes back to Scott every week. And, you know, things are going great for a while. But then, Pete stops writing letters to Scott regularly. What could be happening? Maybe he's busy with school. I mean, he did get straight A's for the first semester, so maybe it's that. Or, he's wearing different clothes now, which symbolizes that now he's a different person, because when you change clothes, automatically it means personality changes. So, and he joins the mean streets of Chicago in a gang called the Blades, and they get into all kinds of trouble, which I'm not really sure exactly what it was. All I saw was them in an alley and then trying to run away from the cops. Cops got him surrounded, and then he gets expelled from school, and then his aunt makes him go home. But I love this too. So when she confronts him about him getting expelled from school, and she's like, all right, can you help me with these? And he's like, what? It's like, you're going back to Elkridge. All he had was one suitcase.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
it.
I understand that. I mean, that can happen, you know, like maybe he knew he was coming back and he still had like a lot of stuff at his grandpa's house. But but the thing is, it's like the fact that she pre-packed for him was weird to me.
Yeah, I know. Like, what? And he's like, I'm taking you to the bus station. He's like,
right now, you know, we're going to catch the next bus.
Like, literally right now. Like, so like, that's like another thing too. So like, we got to remember, Pete is probably at the oldest, maybe 16 years old at this point in the movie, maybe even 15.
He's probably got to be like 12 or 14, I think. He does not.
Oh, really?
You know, I mean, the way that they're playing him off, at least. I don't think he's like, you know, in high school. I think it's more like, maybe, you know, because the other two are like in the, like Scott and his two buddies, frickin' Frack, whatever their names were, Eldon and something else, I think.
I forgot the other two. Yeah.
Those two, I mean, they were all like, because they later on have a dance that's like the end of like junior high or something.
Yeah.
So that, what are you like about 12 or 13 around then? And, you know, maybe 13 when you're a freshman. I'd assume he was probably like a freshman in high school at the most.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know he was older than them, but I don't know by how much, but
I don't even, but the act, I don't even know if he was necessarily older than them like that much, because I don't think he was like, you know, if he was like 16, I don't think a 16-year-old would hang out with like some 13-year-olds.
Yeah, probably not. Well, because he was trying to be a good example though with the buttercreamers and trying to steer the youth in the right direction.
But then again, one of the main tenets of being a buttercreamer is just randomly hanging around with 5-year-old girls.
Yeah, fairly.
In the movie, it seemed like.
I know, it's a weird movie. So Pete, he's got to go home, you know, with his tail in between his legs, and he's all sad and shit, kind of, but then he's still, like, defiant and arrogant. And so, and he's dressed up with his new gang uniform, I guess, I don't know. And then, it just so happens to be, right before Pete returns home, one of Scott's classmates, Margaret, happens to be doing a paper, an extra credit paper, mind you, about Chicago gangs. Wow. You know.
Isn't that coincidental? And of all cities, like, you know, the only gangs she's talking about is Chicago gangs. Like
Chicago gangs, not New York or L.A. Maybe Elk Ridge is in Illinois or something.
And this never said. This gang that he was part of, though, by the way, their outfits were to die for. The one guy was literally wearing a fedora. That's just, you know, I mentioned
fedora,
I'm not sure, but yeah, it's still, he's, and they were all wearing like bandanas, but of different colors.
That's to symbolize the ranks, the hierarchy.
Okay.
I don't know.
Cause like most of them are wearing white, but Pete was wearing a red one. So I'm just like, but usually like the different colors don't get along from what I remember being a kid. But then again, that was all, I think, right around this time, you know, like in the early 90s when I was probably around the same age as these kids, maybe a little older. They, you know, they used to do things like in the schools of my friends, at least, and for us too, on days when we could wear like regular clothing, because we had to wear a uniform most of the time, you couldn't wear certain colors to school.
Wow.
Because they thought, you know, they might represent a gang.
Right.
It was so lame. Like, it's like, we're at a fucking Catholic school. How many of us do you think? I mean, obviously, probably some were in gangs. I don't know, but it was just so weird.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Do you have dreams that you want to achieve, but are scared to do so due to self-doubt, fear, and other people's criticism? I have just what you need. You need a dose of the Living the Dream with Curveball podcast, where I interview guests that will motivate and inspire you to stop at nothing to achieve your dreams. And always remember, if you believe, you can achieve.
The Living the Dream with Curveball podcast is available on your favorite podcast app.
Hey, everybody. Why don't you give the old Black Lincoln Collective podcast a listen? We're funny, we're fat, and we're here 24/7 at blcpodcast.com. Anytime you want to listen, anywhere, all your favorite podcast apps. Of course, we have a YouTube channel where you can stream live with the show. Check out our shorts. We're funnier the less you hear of us. That's been the Black Lincoln Collective podcast at blcpodcast.com.
So Pete, he comes home. His grandpa's acting all like weird and shit when they talk to him, and he's getting into his car. And they're like, "Whoa, what's wrong with Pete? You know, his grandpa's acting kind of weird or whatever." So they go to one thing. You just let themselves in. They don't even like. That's kind of rude, but whatever. No, wait. There's something else that happened. So, okay, I know I'm jumping around here. So there's a scene like you mentioned where this little girl is like, "You have to come do something for me." Like it's like an emergency here. And then it's just SWAT Elvin or whatever his name is to like jump rope and then do this thing called the earthquake. And because he's like a bigger kid, you know?
Yeah.
So like earthquake is then he just falls on the ground and everyone else falls down because it's an earthquake. And that was the huge emergency. And then there's a second emergency shortly thereafter, where I think it was the same girl comes up. They're at baseball practice, mind you.
Yeah.
And she's like, Widow Jenkins fell. Okay, so here's my thing. So she goes, Widow Jenkins fell again. So this is something that's happened multiple occasions.
Uh-huh.
And then she must have known and then ran all the way from the house to the baseball field instead of calling the police.
Yeah, because I have a note here from when I was watching it, and I said,
yeah,
was there no one any closer to help the Widow Jenkins, like the fire department or the cops?
I'm convinced, though, in this town, there is no law enforcement at all. I don't think there is, because everything that's going on in this movie, there's no consequences to the actions of Pete at all throughout this entire film.
And they get on their bikes to drive to Widow Jenkins' house, and it's got to be like a mile away.
Yeah. And also, too, the baseball coach is also the local pastor of the church. And what's hilarious is that, and they're like, we're not done with practice, boys. And they go, I'm sorry, coach. We have more important things to do. Mind you, the pastor / coach is currently wearing his collar still. Mm-hmm. And he goes, what's more important than baseball? Dude, you're a pastor at a church. Like, what the fuck, dude?
Well, didn't you know that in America, it goes baseball, then God? Come on.
I guess so. Or maybe God is a baseball, or baseball is God. I don't know. So they go, yeah, they ride their bikes to the Widow Jenkins' house. Mind you, we don't know this woman's name. We just know her as Widow Jenkins. Okay.
I think it's hilarious. Like, you got to remind this woman every time you talk about her that her husband died.
Exactly. It's like, what the fuck? And then they, like, this really long scene that was just way too long, where they're, like, trying to get in the house. They got to, like, pull up a rope and climb up to the balcony. All this weird shit. And then they finally help her up. And then so that she thanks them. And then she asks, you know, like, hey, is there anything else we can help you out with? And she's like, yeah, you know, can you buy some groceries for me? I'm like, sure.
So my theory, my theory on this,
yeah,
if you don't mind me saying, is that I think she fell just so she could get the kids to go get her groceries.
That could have been true, yeah.
But my feeling about this whole thing before that is, why didn't they break a window on the first floor? They had to go all the way up to the second floor to get into the building.
I don't know.
If you see a woman laying on the ground and you don't know, if she's breathing or what, just break a fucking window and get in. People will understand. Somebody will pay for it. Yeah, so I just don't understand why they didn't break a window or something. But yeah.
Call the cops. Fire department or an ambulance, or, you know, anything that any regular town would have. I'm almost certain this town has no authority. Maybe it's like an anarchist Christian type of commune structure, because it does seem like the whole community looks after one another, which is nice. So anyway, but there was another scene even before that, which I forgot to mention, is that for some reason, Pete was known for quoting commercials to make people feel better about themselves or situations, which I'm not sure.
Just the weirdest.
So I don't really understand, like, why that would do something. And they kept this throughout this whole movie. I cringe every single time they do it. They do the Diet Pepsi commercial from 1990 or whatever. It goes, you got the right one, baby. Oh God. And it's just, yeah, the way they sing.
Ray Charles singing it in the commercial that came out. I looked it up. It came out the year before this movie.
Okay.
So yeah.
So, but the way they say it, especially Eldon is the one that always, like, begins it. Like, he's the first person to start the chant. And the way he says it, I just want to, like, strangle him. Like, I know he's a kid in this movie. I mean, he's probably older than I am in real life. But,
yeah.
Like, I just hate the way he says those words. It's just like, it's just like nails on a chalkboard type of situation for me.
If you happen to be listening, the actor who played this
role,
Brandon Blazer, if you're listening to this podcast, we've covered two of your movies so far. So if you'd like to come on and talk about it,
yeah,
and explain to Sesame why he shouldn't strangle you.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
No, I'm joking.
I do like Treasure Mountain, though, because he's the hero of Treasure Mountain.
Yeah.
And that's a good movie. And I don't think Scott was in that movie at all, was he?
Oh, Scott's in it. Pete's not in it.
It's okay. He obviously is not, because at that point he probably got killed or something. But, like, and speaking of Pete here, honestly, I know this town must be, like, full of, like, Christian saints that just all happen to live in the same town in America. But, like, I would have just killed him within the first 20 minutes of the movie. Like, he's just a piece of shit. But, like, anyway, so...
And Pete sounds like he's a 1940s gangster.
He does. And the way, yeah, the way he talks.
He's like, what's up? Come on, guys. You know, we're gonna go down by the pond, you know, and we're gonna...
I will say this though, I do think the guy who played him was a really good actor.
Oh, yeah, he was great, but I just don't understand his accent in relation to the other guys or to Chicago or anywhere else. Like, he sounds like he's from New York or something.
I don't know either.
I don't know where he's from, but yeah.
But I know I'm jumping all over the place because I watched it twice, but I'm still trying to process it because it's such a weird movie. So there, when he was in Chicago, as soon as like when he first got to Chicago, hey, he's walking upstairs to his aunt's apartment or whatever she lived in. And she's like lying out clothes on like a clothesline. And then she's like asking him like how his day at school was or whatever. And he's like, oh, it was great. I got straight A's or whatever. She goes, that's great. If your parents were alive, they'd be proud of you.
This movie just loves reminding people they loved died. Like widowed Jenkins your parents died.
But the way she delivered the line was like so like stoic. And,
Michael D. Weathered is Pete. I don't know how old he is, but Jason Johnson's just a little bit older than me. Okay. Brandon Blazer, who plays Eldon, is like 2 years older than me.
Okay.
So he's older than Scott.
Okay. He's got the right one, baby. So so there's that whole thing. You know, they don't make a phone call to the cops or the fire department or ambulance, what have you. They instead, they agree to buy some groceries from her at the local kind of convenience stores type small grocery store. It's not like a real big one. It's just like a small store. She says the word treat. And this word comes up probably about 200 times throughout the whole movie after she says this word, and it just comes up over and over and over and over again. And even Pete, multiple occasions, refers to it as treats as he's stealing. And I'm like, I can't take anyone seriously who is using the word treat as he's stealing something. Like, it just, like, it takes away any edge. Like, hey, man, I stole these treats. Like,
didn't you know that treats are the gateway crime to even larger crimes?
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, like,
I mean, when you know, hostess eyes, like, if you snatch a hostess, you know, you're a criminal the mostest, you know, yeah, so.
And John Gotti started out stealing Little Debbie cakes. It's a well-known fact.
Yes, it's true. And this leads into a thing. So they go buy some treats, or not, rather. This is the first conundrum in the movie, because, again, it's the morality tale of the highest order. It's very complex. It's very philosophical. You need to really dig in and think deep about this movie. And so first conundrum is when they're buying some groceries for the widow, Jenkins, which we don't know what her name is, and we never learn what it is. The owner of the store, Mr. Raff, or whatever his name is, he tells the story for like the millionth time, apparently, according to Eldon, that he was a buttercreamer himself back in the day, and also one of his grandfathers was the founder of the buttercream gang. The origin of the buttercream gang is, this is not a double entendre, but I think it was they didn't know because they were pure-hearted Christians. You know, they weren't thinking dirty like most people or myself would think.
They were pure-hearted Christians who go on to commit telephone fraud.
So a tornado killed a bunch of the men, which is weird. I don't know why it only killed men. There was a lot of widows left around, and the founders helped churn their butter. I'm just saying, weird phrase, because they're churning the widow's butter, and
everybody loves to.
That's what it calls themselves,
butter some widow's cream. Butter,
and that's what they call themselves, the butter cream gang. And then the first conundrum is that Mr. Graff, he gives them the treats. Again, he uses that word treat, which is going to come up many times over in this film, for free, because, you know, one butter creamer to the next or whatever type of thing.
Yeah.
Eldon was like, oh, well, because he said, you know, give the change back to
Widow Jenkins.
And Eldon's like, well, why don't we just spend the money that she gave us on extra treats? I'm like, you know, a capitalist, you know, kind of mindset, you know? And they're like, no, we shouldn't do that. I'm like, okay, so.
Well, I think they were slightly playing up because he's a little bit heavier than the other kids.
That was a thing they kept. Yeah, they kept.
I mean, this was a stereotypical thing. Like you had Jerry O'Connell's character in Stand By Me around the time, and you had the, you know, heavier kid in like Ham and Sandlot and stuff like that. You know, it's just that's the sort of thing you did. You know.
Yeah, I mean, because he talked about stuff like I've had enough exercise for one day or whatever type of thing. You know, I'm asking that. And so they go and try to find Pete. They just pretty much just break into his house without asking, you know, or anything like that. And then they find Pete. By the way, there's some great cinematography in this film. So like they're going in and you can see the camera just slowly moving, and you finally see Pete, and he's like decked out in his gang clothes or whatever. And then
With a Pepsi in his hand. And
yeah, and he's got peanut butter that looks like he's just has sitting there for no apparent reason. He's not even eating it. He's got some bread just there too. And then they're like, hey, you know, wow, you look different or whatever. He's like, yeah, you like the new threads, pretty cool, right? And Scott's like, yeah, you look different. He's like, yeah, so do you. It's all right though. So that's the first part right there of the rift between Scott and Pete begins at this very moment, right at the reunion, is that Scott notices that Pete looks different because he's wearing different type of clothes, which symbolizes that he's a different kind of person, because that's how that reality. And then this rift gets bigger and bigger and bigger throughout the whole film, culminating at the end when they end up killing each other in a battle royale.
Yeah, it was like Gladiator. It was just great.
Yeah. So Pete keeps evading their questions, like, yo, what's going on? Are you okay or whatever? And he's like, I'm hungry. You're hungry? Let's go get some treats. I'm buying. I'm like, god damn, the word treat, it just keeps showing up. And then I'm like, why do they keep focusing on this word treat so many times? And I mean, like literally like 100 to 200 times throughout the goddamn film, it just keeps coming up. And then
it's
so,
like, buy a fucking thesaurus, somebody.
And then so Pete is like leading them to the Mr. Graff's. Okay, so this is like, I'm like ADHD in my today, like, yeah, some reason. So for years it seems that Mr. Graff is not the kind-hearted person that he portrays himself as, but instead had utilized what I'm assuming is free child labor from Pete for a period of years, it seems like. No pay, no nothing. Well, and
they never say that he didn't get paid.
Well, later on, though, he does say something about all the help I did and get anything for it. So
that could just mean like, oh, on top of my work, I, you know, sometimes, oh, okay, would you know,
well,
do extra work or something.
Okay, well, in my mind, he's in my mind, it was child labor. So
either way, it's child labor. It's just not if it's being paid or not.
Yeah, that's my canon right there. Like, yeah. And then so Pete, they're like, I'm thirsty. And they're like, okay, well, why don't you go get the drinks? And I'll go get the treats or whatever. God damn it, you know. And then now I'm staying. And then Scott, you know, thinks, you know, there's something up because Pete's acting like really weird and like extra nice to the Mr. Graff, and just like he's acting like way too nice and sensitive, and just like gives off a weird, creepy vibe, like he's about to do something illegal or whatever.
And he says he wants to find out where the shoelaces are so he can go look at those, is what he says.
Yeah. And then so he goes back there, and then meanwhile he's like sneaking around buying or stealing treats. And then Scott doesn't really see it, but he's kind of looking suspicious, you know, see what's going on or whatever. And so you know, they leave. Mr. Graff reminds Eldon for probably the millionth time at this point not to drink soda inside the store. He goes, oh, sorry, I forgot. No, you didn't, you're just an idiot. And so Pete then says, oh no, I was looking for the neon colored shoelaces. Can you give me a call when those come in? Okay, sure. Meanwhile, he either looks like he's about to shit in pants the way he's walking, or it's obvious he has stuff in his pants the way he's walking. And also,
he looks like me when I have my heavier coat going in to see a movie at the movie theater. When I stop at the Walmart and get a bunch of candy and put it in there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so obvious that, I mean, like, and he's like walking all weird. He's like slinking out the door and shit. And then also, too, right as they get out of the door, like in full view of everyone.
I know. Right in front of the window.
Just takes out his pockets and throws each person the treat. He's like, one for you, one for you, one for you, whatever, like being all cool about it. And I'm like, oh my god. And so they're like, oh, okay, well, we're gonna go help with working on someone's yard or whatever. Do you want to help us? And Pete's like, no, I gotta go, whatever. He's like, fine. And then Scott then calls a group meeting while they're walking the lawn that they're gonna work on, and he's like, I think there's something wrong with Pete. And they're like, what are you talking about? Just because he looks a little bit different doesn't mean... So that's a huge theme in this movie, which again, I'm actually kind of surprised, because most Christian movies or Christian adjacent movies are really big on judging people based on how they dress and how they look and their appearances and stuff like that. So I was kind of surprised that this movie played a lot of emphasis on not judging people about how they dress. I was actually quite surprised. Anyway, what else happened? Sir, do you have any thoughts?
Nothing really. But I basically next we have Pete goes and so like there's this girl Margaret who has glasses, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean she's a nerd,
of course.
And she had done this report on the Gangs of Chicago, which is the sequel to the Martin Scorsese film The Gangs of New York.
And he also worked with the 4Fs to produce it. And yeah. And they called a bunch of people to get the word out. And
Daniel Day-Lewis plays the older version of Pete just brilliantly.
Yes. Oh, God.
Leonardo DiCaprio plays Scott. It's just so great, man.
Yeah, it's a great movie. A great sequel.
Oh, my God. I think I found a better movie. It's going to be called The Buttercream Gang of New York.
Yeah, The Buttercream Gangs of New York. Yes.
I think I found our next t-shirt.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So look for that in our Tee Public store. Yes. We're going to have a t-shirt that's going to be called The Buttercream Gangs of New York.
Oh, God.
So anyways, we've got...
I'm kidding.
Laughing at my own idea. Anyway, so Thea, we've got so they're like, you know, they both can't decide on if they, I mean, the other guys can't decide if they think Pete's a bad apple now or whatnot. Margaret says something like there's something bad going on or something. Is this when she comes and tells them about it?
At first he asks if he could borrow the paper, and
her paper on the Gangs of Chicago, and
And she's like, I'm not a delivery service. You got to come walk with me to school. You got to go sit on the fucking porch while she goes and like.
Well, you see, this is the point where it basically just really proves the fact that women mature faster than guys because she totally wants Scott. So she's just like.
I know, but he's like being a complete fucking moron.
But she wears glasses.
I know. Well, they do a Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. That's why I was pointing that out because.
See what she's all that. Later on, them kind of, but it's like more innocent because they're kids, you know. But they do a she's all that,
yeah,
you know, the Christian version of that kind of thing later on in the film, which you know, that gets really heated up. It's almost like a firecracker, you know, goes on. Anyway. I'm getting ahead of myself. That was a dumb joke,
yes. So basically the one thing about that scene on the porch where he's asking her for the thing, I think there's a little girl there. I think that's like Scott's sister or something.
Yeah, I think so. We never really learned.
She's standing on the porch while they're having this conversation, like really creepy in the corner. And for some odd reason, my thing is it's I don't blame her. I blame the cinematography or the direction. You could have her standing there, cut to her every so often, but she's like in every shot, just standing there in the corner looking on creepily.
She's like spying on them. Yeah.
It's just so creepy. Anyways, I don't know. He gets the paper because he wants to find out more about, you know, these vicious gangs in New York where the kids are going down alleys and getting caught by cops. And after they murdered a family of four. And
four of the 4Fs. And,
yes, all four of them.
Yes.
They murdered the family films for, or the feature films for families, all 4Fs.
It's 3 a.m. doing solicitations and like, God damn it, quit calling me.
So he gets this paper. He gets home after talking to Margaret, talks to his dad about the treats or whatever. And Scott's dad advises him to return the treats and tell Graf what happened, but also confront Pete before making any accusations.
About stealing the treats.
Yeah, the treats.
Yeah,
you know, good old Pete's treats.
Yes,
that's the Buttercream Gang Part 3, Pete's treats. Ah, boy. So we've got that happening, and so he ends up going into his room, and Pete's hanging out on his bed.
How'd he get there? No one knows.
And I don't know. Maybe he wants to offer Scott some treats. Oh wait, sorry. So he thanks Scott for not turning him in to Graf and promises to apologize and pay for the treats.
Yes.
Yeah, he tries to say that he acquired these bad habits from his gang in Chicago. I almost said New York again.
Gangs of New York, yeah. Yes. Buttercream Gangs of New York.
So, but while he's talking to Pete, his little sister overhears the whole thing. And so instead of like, you know, going to an adult, she goes to Margaret.
Yeah.
Because again, I think this town is run by children.
I think so. There's no adult supervision. There's no police, apparently. It's just like the adults just let the children, I guess, learn the hard way. I don't know. And then
find out in a deleted scene that the mayor is just some 12-year-old kid.
kid.
I'm telling you, I think this is a proto-anarcho-Christian type of society where there's the law of the Bible, but not the real law, but like the Bible teachings are the law, but no one enforces the law. You only enforce it on your own self, you know? So I'm pretty sure that's what this town is.
Yes. And it's run by 12-year-olds.
Yes.
And random 5-year-olds. So this little girl goes to Margaret instead of to, you know, the parents or the police or anybody else or to Mr. Graff or anybody, you know, about the situation. Basically, what Margaret tells this little girl to do is to literally stalk a gang member. After writing this expose on the gangs of Chicago, she's like, yeah, go stalk this one and see what he's up to. You know, nothing bad could happen if he finds you stalking him.
No.
It's not like he's going to kill you or something. But anyways.
I mean, we don't know because Scott's dad even said to Scott when they're outside on the porch, and then his sister was eavesdropping this whole time. And right before they go and eat dinner, he tells Scott, he goes, real gangs are real dangerous. So if you think he was in one, then you need to be careful. And so it's like, yeah, send his 5-year-old to spy and report back on what the activities are of Pete's new gang.
I hear that's how we won World War II.
Yes.
It was 5-year-old spies.
It's like Spy Kids for real. And, you know, Spy Kids Nuremberg edition or something.
God. Then we basically have, you know, she goes to stalk. She goes off to stalk him. Basically, we have, she assembles her friends to do it. So it's not just her, mind you.
True, yeah.
There are several little Muppet baby spies or something or whatever you want to call them.
And anyway, several children are being endangered, so it's not just one. So that's good. And
that makes it better.
Yeah, I guess so. And
It's like when there's wars and there's more death, it doesn't matter as much to people somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess that makes sense. You know,
So we have this. we have this great montage following that.
Yes.
And with Pete and his new gang, there's some random other bullies from school that he becomes a gang member with.
He recruited them. He's like a capitalist dude. Like he saw them and saw like what they were capable of. He immediately went up to them and he started teaching them gang stuff. Apparently, what to do if you're in a gang, I guess. Like, I don't know what, you know, whatever.
And then he saw potential in him. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, obviously, he probably saw potential in Scott and Lanny and Alden before because, you know, he was the leader of the Buttercreamers. And,
he was the head Buttercreamer.
Oh, yeah. And basically, the funny thing, too, about the Buttercreamers thing, too, is like there's the montage and the little friends of the little sister and everything and Margaret, she calls them the Buttercreamettes.
Yeah, that's so creative.
Yeah. So Lanny and Eldon and Scott, you know, try to decide if Pete should continue in the gang or not. And at that point, they're debating this. And Margaret approaches the treehouse to report that the Buttercreamettes have been observing and implores Scott to take some action because she owes him a favor. First, she says, you owe me a favor. I need you to take some action against Pete. But before leaving, she says that, but that's not the favor. The favor is I need you to take me to this dance.
Yep.
Yeah, there's like a end of the year dance sort of thing. So later on, we've got this situation where Scott is badly delivering newspapers and he spies on Pete and his gang and he sees them bullying Margaret. And by bullying, I mean they're riding around her on their bicycles.
And taunting her.
Yeah, making fun of her because she wears glasses.
Mm, get it?
So she's a geek.
Glasses.
Yep. And then Scott's looking on and then he intervenes and, you know, saved the day. Runs in.
Finally, he waited like 10 minutes and then.
Yeah. He's like contemplating here and he's just like, you know, if they kill her, I won't have to go to this dance.
Yeah.
Like, you know what you'll have to go to, buddy? A funeral.
Yeah.
He runs his bike into one of the gang members and knocks him over, you know, in a kind Christian way. But he does, you know, but he does save the day. And, you know, he's sitting there, he's like, you know, but he did a contemplating, you know, situation where he's just like, do I like her enough? Do I care? You know, but Pete, like, you know, basically is getting all mean to him and everything. And he's like, you know, why are you defending this geek and all this shit? And Scott basically determines, you know, you're out of the gang. And then, but Pete's like, you know, you can't fire me. I quit, you know, sort of thing. Seeing that his new, you know, Tweedledum and Tweedledee friends are, you know, good enough for him. And Then we've got the night of the dance. What happens there?
So Scott shows up dressed to the nines, and Margaret's mom's at the door. She has him sit down on the porch with her, and then Margaret comes out, and she's not wearing glasses. And Scott's like, "What?" You know,
faintly in my brain, I hear, "Kiss me."
Right. And then, like, the suave dude that Scott is, he says that his mom bought the corsage for her, because why would you say that? Like, why would, okay. And then, I mean, like, what the fuck, dude? Like, I mean, it's just, like, the weird shit that, I don't know. Maybe the writers actually are pretty good, and they knew how to make him really awkward. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not horrible, but it's still, it's like, that's not something you say to a girl, you know, if you're trying to impress her or something, but I don't know if he is or not.
That's the thing.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And so they're going to the, walking to the dance. He's basically accidentally implying that he doesn't really want to go with her, which upsets her. And then they get to the dance, and
he says the reason that he doesn't want to go with her is that because he doesn't know how to dance.
Yeah, that he's afraid of that. So yeah, and so they're at this, they're doing a slow dance, and Eldon and Lanny are just standing there awkwardly, and then two girls come up and each ask one of them to dance with them. There's a bunch of other girls standing right behind them, looking all sad, like they missed out on this great opportunity to dance with Earthquake Eldon and Buzzcut Lanny, you know. And it's just like,
I mean, just okay, it's like, you know, they could have danced with Daniel Day-Lewis and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Just joking. With Leo, I don't know, because I know he likes him young, but I don't think he likes him that young. So you know, sorry, that was me.
Well, at the time, to be fair, he was their age, so
I know that was, sorry, that was mean of me to,
I mean, he does have that thing, you know, like once they turn like 20, he doesn't.
Oh, it's 26, I think.
I know. I'm joking.
Whatever. I'm mean spirited. Come on. But whatever. And so while they're slow dancing and they're like practically hugging each other, so obviously Scott does kind of like Margaret. And then Pete ruins it by throwing a firecracker right at her feet, and then it explodes. I mean, not really explode, whatever, you know.
Goes off, yeah.
It goes off.
I mean, that still is dangerous, even with that little thing, because that little fire could have caught Margaret's dress on fire or something.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And then, so then Scott goes and runs after him and pretty much challenges him to a fight the next day. And they're like, all right. And one of my favorite lines is, they're like, yeah, you're toast. And then they go, yeah, burnt toast.
I have that written down in my notes, too.
Yeah, it's just like, I love that. And like, Pete looks back after he said that, though. Like, he's like, that was a good line. Like,
I'm going to have to remember that.
Every time I'm getting into a fight with someone, I'm going to call them. I'm going to say, you're going to be burnt toast and see what happens.
I mean, I would go into, like, you know, I'd be like, you're going to be toast, you know, like French toast. Oh, wait, what? You know, that's not right.
Cinnamon toast.
Cinnamon toast crunch. Wait, what?
Yeah. Avocado toast or whatever. Yeah.
And that's the reason I can't afford an apartment.
Yeah, it's because, yeah, exactly, or a house, because too much guacamole or whatever.
Too much Starbucks and avocado toast. Anyways, so.
And speaking of toast, so there's like a, you know, like there's kind of like a joke that like British cuisine is basically just like a bunch of shit food or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so, which, you know, some of it's true. And then there's actually a thing called a toast sandwich, which actually sounds pretty good. So it's just, you just toast a piece of bread, mm-hmm. and then you just put that in between regular pieces of bread that aren't toasted, and you put like some butter on it. I'm like, okay, I can actually go for something like that. Like, you know,
so like two untoasted pieces of bread with a toasted piece in the middle.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, I can, you know, I mean, I would have to put more than just butter on it. Maybe some peanut butter, some jam.
That really sounds like something that came out of the Depression or World War II or something, you know?
I think so. Yeah.
And so,
speaking of Depression, this movie's making me depressed. But because Pete plays, as the guy who plays Pete, plays his heart out in this role that's so silly, but he does all he can to make it serious, because there's nothing serious about this movie. You're constantly saying the word treat. You're saying things like burnt toast. You're circling people with bikes. You're kicking flowers. Like, that's your big gain activities. You're like lighting random shit on fire that's not even dangerous. You're you actually refer to your fellow gang members as gang members. Like,
yeah,
really? And like, so
I looked him up, the actor, Michael Weathered. He went on to do a lot of like guest spots on TV shows and stuff, but he had a substantial role in the David Lynch film Mulholland Drive.
Oh, okay.
So that's just kind of weird. You go from Buttercream Gang to David Lynch.
Well, it's the Buttercream to Lynch pipeline.
Yes. You know,
very well known pipeline. Wow. And so you know, the big fight's gonna happen, but then happens to be Sunday, so they're at church. And of course, the pastor, the same pastor who thinks baseball is more important than God, and he's delivering a sermon.
I want to point something out really quick about the church thing that I made a note of. Okay, so when he's coaching the baseball team, he's wearing a collar.
Yeah,
but when he's in service, he's wearing a tie.
I wonder if that was a mistake, like they wore like the clothes,
or if this is some kind of thing like where they just have like random like collared things that they wear sometimes, and I don't know. It's just strange because he had like a. He had two different, you know, baseball outfits too. Like one was like tan and the other one was blue. So I don't know.
Right. So, but maybe it's a symbol to say that he likes baseball more than God. And so it was like baseball is a true religion.
Yes.
Christianity is a hobby to him.
Yes.
Oh no.
Christianity is a hobby.
Yes. Yes. And, this movie has layers, Mike. Okay. There's so much.
Yes.
So much more to the Buttercream Gang.
Much like toast, it has layers.
Yes, it does. So you really got to dig deep and watch this movie about 100 times to really get to the core of it. So he is delivering this turn the other cheek sermon, of course, and he's like, the Old Testament law has been replaced. You know, we don't do eye for an eye anymore. You know, we don't love people based on, you know, whether or not they're going to change. We just do it because that's the right thing to do. That was the other thing too. So like there's this big plot in the movie, or this big message of the movie that's basically about like not trying to manipulate people into changing. Like, because Scott throughout this whole movie, he's trying to be nice to Pete. He's trying to do nice things for Pete, but he's doing it with the expectation that he's going to change. And Pete understands this, so it makes him like resent Scott even more because he knows that's what he's doing and that he's not really. Mm-hmm. He's not really doing it. And so like Pete, you know, is going through, you know, some stuff here because he, you know, he doesn't really like the person that he's become. And so like he'll like go back and forth, or like he'll kind of like go back to his old self for like a few minutes, and then he'll like realize what's happening, and then he'll quit, you know, and go back to his new path or whatever. And then they get into this huge argument because, you know, after the sermon, Scott decides that, you know, they don't want to fight the new gang or whatever. So they do like a white flag of surrender or whatever. And then they ask Pete to meet Scott alone by the river or the creek or whatever. And so Scott challenges Pete to spend the next day with them, just hanging out or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, they start doing what they used to do, like going fishing and swimming in the pond or the creek or whatever. And then they're hanging out at the treehouse afterwards. And he's like, yeah, it's just like old times or whatever. And Pete's like, yeah, but it's really not old times. And he's like, well, but it could be. And he's just like, no, it's like, you know, people change or whatever and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, they get into this big fight because, you know, Pete doesn't like what Scott's trying to do and stuff like that. And he goes, not once did you guys ask me what happened in Chicago. Not once. And it's like, but they literally did the first moment they saw you.
Exactly. When
they house. Like, what are you talking about?
You just didn't tell them.
And yet you evaded the question by saying, let's go to the store and steal treats. And it's like,
well, you know, when you've got a treat on your mind, that's all you can think about is treats. Did I mention treats?
Exactly. Yeah, did you mention treat Williams?
rest in peace. Anyway, so
yeah. Yeah, rest in peace, totally. And I forgot that he died, actually.
Yeah.
And so he gets, so now they're like enemies because of that perfect day they spent, and then they got ruined at the last moment. And so Scott, the next day, he's playing the championship baseball game, and so Pete decides to heckle him Which is another weird thing. So how is the umpire just allowing Pete to like heckle the, like he's like, he's going over the field. Like
you,
what's that?
Like, you can get kicked out of like a professional baseball game for doing that. I'm assuming you could at a Little League game. Cause there was like this, like really annoying guy the last time I was at a Mud Hens game who just kept like taunting the visiting team. I don't know who they were, but he was really into the sport. He like knew all their names and like all this other stuff. And like, and their minor, the team below them, and was like totally like saying you're gonna go down to the whatever team and all this other stuff, and like just yelling at them. And we were right by the pitchers warm up. What is that called? Anyways, the pitching coach down there looked at him and gave him a look and just like kind of pointed at him, and it's just basically like, you know, you better stop or you're getting out of here. And this was the Mud Hens pitching coach too. So, you know, so
yeah.
Like, yeah.
And so, you know, he starts off by the behind the fence. So it's like, okay. But then he gets to the point where he's like right behind the fence where he's batting.
Yeah.
And he's like, the thing is too, like Pete's grandfather is just like standing there behind him, like not doing anything to reprimand. That's the other thing too. Like, his grandfather is completely helpless. Like, he does nothing to rein Pete in. Like, there's no stern talking to. There's no nothing.
No.
And then he's like, I'm sorry. I wish, like, there's more I could do. It's like, more? You've done nothing.
You could do something.
And then, like, Scott yells at him. He's like, you could send him back to Chicago where he belongs. And then, you know, he acts all, like, hurt and offended. It's like, well, dude, like, you're not doing shit for your grandson, okay? That's the other thing about this movie. So, you know, you want to get really deep into it, you know. Because we're all focusing on Pete here and his bad behavior and shit like that. Well, Pete obviously has some kind of mental illness going on, and the town's doing nothing to treat it.
I know.
Treat it. And so...
Yeah, you don't. You treat it with treats, man. That's all you do. You give them little debbies.
They're doing all this other shit, like trying to get him to change by manipulating him, by... Eventually, the whole town just starts like giving him shit for free, and it just makes him even more mad. So he just starts doing worse shit, and then they keep giving him more stuff, and it just like,
and that's how like, we get stopped. Donald Trump as president.
Yeah, well, yeah, wait, exactly.
It was so I want to mention something about the baseball game really quick, if I can.
Sure.
So in one shot, the scoreboard says that the Red Sox, which is the team that Scott's on, has 6 points and the Braves have 5. Then the announcer says that there has been a complete turnaround and the Braves lead by 2. But the scoreboard says that the Red Sox have 8 and that the Braves have 7.
Okay. So they like stole a point from
They just had the wrong score on the board, I think.
Yeah, and so what happened? So after the game, he gets benched because he's Scott's at, but then the pastor /coach comes first, pastor comes second, and he's like, let's just hit some balls, so you don't want to end the season with you getting kicked off or getting kicked out of the game or whatever.
Yeah,
and so he starts talking about Mahatma Gandhi, about nonviolence, and how that's how India won its independence, which is actually not actually true. Gandhi himself actually said that his tactics wouldn't have worked if there weren't other people who were committing violence. But then we're not going to get into that, And we're going to get into the whitewash version of.
Yeah, I'll say where does actual history matter when you're talking about school history or whatever?
Right. So, exactly. Yeah. So he's basically making the point that Scott shouldn't like try to change Pete or try to face up against him and that kind of stuff. So then he gets the idea of like, hey. At one point he has his gang beat up Scott actually right after the game. And then Scott shows up again at the rail yard where they hang out. And, he just straight up just gives Pete his bike. Cause Pete's like, he's like, you're going to be my friend no matter what you do, Pete. I love you. And then he's like, oh yeah. What if I took your bike? He's like, well, you don't have to here. And so he's like, what?
The whole thing is like Mr. Graff had said something like that too. It's like, if he doesn't want to, Scott told him about the stealing and he's just like, basically like, well, next time I'll just give him the treat.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like we had this montage too, where they're like, they're going to like go into a store and steal stuff. And then like, he just comes out the door with a bunch of sodas already. He's like, oh, have a seat or whatever, And then like, they're about to sit down. He's like, no, Pete's on to shit. He knows what's going on. Like the other people don't know. It's his fellow gang members, which they're called gang members. They don't know what's going on.
Cause there's an alternate version where Mr. Graff joins up Pete's gang.
Yes, yes. It's a really sad story, that one. But and so like the whole town just starts doing this. Like, and it's like pissing him off even more because like he knows what they're doing. He's acting out even more, which then makes them even treat him better, which then makes him act out more, so he can't take it. So it gets to the point where this leads into one of the best scenes I've ever seen in a movie ever. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, this scene is in the books. Like, it's one for the books. Like, so it starts off with, they're like, again, because there's no police in this town. So they're like, Pete's in trouble. Someone broke into his house or whatever. Don't call the cops because they don't exist. And then,
actually, during that scene, Margaret finally at one point says, maybe we should call the cops or call the police. Yeah, she does at one point. She says that.
So finally,
and she does.
They get the right. Which is, again, this is why I'm assuming this is some kind of anarcho-Christian town where they only call the police on very rare occasions where they absolutely need them to. Otherwise, they solve their issues themselves. But at this point, this guy is holding up Pete. He's wearing, like, pantyhose around his face or whatever. And he's like, he wants Pete's grandfather's coin collection or something.
Yeah, like gold coins then, of some sort.
Yeah. And then Pete's like, don't worry, you know, the insurance will pay for it. Just don't let him hurt me or whatever. And so, you know, Scott and Earthquake, Eldon and Buzzcut Lanny, they say the name. They basically incapacitate this guy. And then the guy's like, thinks Pete is, double crossing him.
Yeah.
And so, like,
we find out
they think
Pete was in on it.
Yeah, so they think, like, Pete's going to finally be glad because they saved them, but he's even more pissed off because they ruined his trick or whatever. So then he goes and just bolts out of there, just runs as fast as he can, again, with the camera work. So he, like, walks into the store, and his camera just goes straight into the face of the owner of the store, Mr. Grab, and then, like, proceeds into the best scene I've ever seen in the movie, where he's like, give me all your money, old man. And the guy's like, okay, here. Here you go. Here's $226. Is that okay? And he's like, don't you understand? You're being robbed. He's like, oh, I know it's what you're trying to do, but if I give you the money, then you're not robbing me. And he's like, what? That's all crazy. You know, when someone's trying to rob you, you don't give them the money and say, now you're not robbing me. <I'm> like, and he gets this club out of nowhere. He just starts trashing the whole...
Yeah, the whole store.
He starts trashing the whole store. And then Scott shows up and he's like, you know, what are you doing, Pete? And he's like, shut up. I'll hit you right over the head with this or whatever. And he ends up like knocking something down real hard off the shelf. And then he's like, you're my friend, Pete. I'll love you no matter what you do. And he's like, no, I want you to hate me. Because why? Because I hate myself. He just runs off. I'm like, there it is. Finally. He admits that he hates himself. That's why he's acting out. I mean, we could have guessed that throughout the whole movie, 20 minutes in.
You know who else could have guessed that? Maybe if his grandfather would have been like, hey, let's talk to the like school guidance counselor or somebody in town or the coach priest. And been like
the coach priest.
Yeah.
There's probably at least a couple of therapists in town.
Yeah.
Not outside of town. You could find maybe a psychiatrist. That's the other thing, too. So I feel like definitely want to kill Pete. I think he's a piece of shit. But, like, I also feel kind of bad for him because, like, this kid is obviously struggling with some kind of mental health issues. And they're just like, no, what we're going to do? We're just going to, like, taunt him by, like, doing nice things for him. And it's, like, kill him with kindness. Because at one point, it's like, you're trying to remember about the great person I used to be. And it's just like, dude, that is, like, torture if you think about it. Like, it's, like, worse than punishing someone because you're just like, yeah.
I wonder if anybody watched this movie and took that lesson to heart. And like, there's some like really mean bully at a school or like worse, like a gang member at your school.
Yeah.
Like a real, you know, like guy with a gun, you know, doing drive-bys gang member or something.
Yeah.
And somebody watched this movie and just decided, you know what? I'm going to give him Little Debbie snacks and, you know, other treats, stuff for free. And I'm just going to, you know, anytime I see him, I'm going to do nice things for him. You know, I don't know if that worked out as well, you know, for them.
He might get shot. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. But I mean, it might work. But the thing is, so you got to understand the psychological damage this entire town is doing to Pete. It's one thing if it's one person. You got an entire town unite with a united front, and they're all doing this in tandem with each other. It's going to make you lose your mind.
Exactly.
Like, that's like psychological torture that they're doing to this poor kid. It's like, hey, maybe just take him to a therapist. Maybe get him on some medication. Maybe he's got something going on, you know, mentally. Maybe
There's
got
to be one of these, like, seven-year-olds in town that has a therapy degree, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, they're the ones that run the town.
Yeah, so, exactly.
You know? I mean, like, think about it. He's got parents that are dead. He's got an aunt that reminds him of that in the weirdest way possible by saying, if your parents were alive, they would have been proud of you. And just like that kind of monotone. And then you got Grandpa, whatever, Turner, who just, like,
Grandpa
checked out of life.
Grandpa,
like,
neglectful or whatever, you know?
Doesn't talk to Pete, apparently, doesn't have any boundaries, doesn't have any rules, just lets him do whatever. And that's the other thing too. And so how many laws has Pete broken in this movie that has no one, that's never gone punished? Like the firecracker thing, that could be a thing right there. Beating someone up, that's physical assault. Stealing. But that's the other thing too. There's montage too, where it's like the dichotomy of man thing going on. So like with Pete and his gang members, they're like stealing tomatoes, like green tomatoes from like a vineyard or whatever. Not vineyard, but
garden or whatever. Yeah.
And then like, they're like, haha, we're stealing these tomatoes or whatever. And they're like throwing them or whatever. And then it goes to like the buttercream gang that shows them like picking them gently and they're like doing good deeds. And then it's like, it goes back to Pete's gang and just doing like destructive behavior. Whereas the creamers, they're doing like good things, no, whatever. And it's like, and they got the song. This song was like, this guy like wrote his heart into the song for the buttercream gang. Like, I hope he wrote other songs beside this. He's like, living on the streets has changed the way he sees the world. Or no, it's something like, he sees the world through different eyes or something like that. And it's like, yeah, the mean streets of Chicago with the blades and whatever crime that they did, which they didn't really explain what they did. Because apparently they got out of jail, or they didn't even go to jail. They got arrested and nothing happened to them.
There are three songs listed in the soundtrack on the Internet Movie Database.
Okay.
One's called Dreams of a Better Day.
Yes, that's the one.
Music and lyrics by Kurt Bester, performed by Judd Marr.
Of a Better Day. I love that. And then, sorry, my voice is going out from talking about this movie. But I just can't get over the fact that an entire town, like, you gotta just imagine, like, the Twilight Zone shit must be going through your mind at that point. Where, like, everybody in town is, like, intentionally fucking with you, but, like, in the nicest way possible. And you hate yourself already for the bad shit you do. And then you hate yourself even further now because the bad shit you do against the people that you love are doing nice things for you. But it's not just one person. It's every, well, except for the grandfather, because the grandfather apparently doesn't give a shit about him because he's nowhere to be found at all. So I'm sorry. I've like talked over you this whole time.
Oh, no, you're good. You're very passionate about this film, and I feel it.
I am very passionate. I love this movie. So, but can I talk about the ending? And you can come in too. But
yeah, go ahead.
Ending.
I have many questions and many comments about the ending.
Yes. So the ending is one of the worst cliffhangers I've ever seen. So he goes back to Chicago, doesn't write Scott a single letter the entire time. Scott's been writing him letters for a whole goddamn year. Doesn't get the fucking hint that Pete's not going to write him back. And then, so he gets home from school one day, and then like 15 people from the town are all standing there looking solemn.
Well, before that, though, Margaret says somehow she tells Scott that Pete went back to Chicago. How did Margaret know and not him?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just weird. And then so Margaret's got everyone looking like super sad. Scott's freaking out like, oh my God, they're going to tell me that Pete fucking died to get shot or something like that. And then like, it doesn't always turn out this way. Like, I'm like, oh God. So it's like, he basically saying like, you know, you did the right thing, but you know, there's not always a happy ending. And then Margaret's like, I'm really proud of you. And she's got tears in her eyes. I'm like, oh my fucking God. They're going to, because I forgot about the end of this movie.
Yeah.
I'm like, are they going to do this with Pete fucking dying? Like, I was seriously worried. I'm like,
I was too.
I'm like, I didn't remember the ending. And then they're like, there's an article with Pete's name in it. And I'm like, oh, like, holy shit. Like, and then like, and like, they're like looking like all sad and shit. I'm like, this is not the time to do the fake sad prank. And then it turns out
this isn't the time to punk a kid. You know what I mean?
No, it's not. Come on. Like, after your best friend leaves after having a full on mental breakdown at this company's, the town store, saying that he hates himself and he wants other people to hate him for it, yeah, when the whole town has been psychologically torturing him for like weeks at this point, and then he just disappears, and then you got like the whole town standing in your goddamn living room with sad faces. You got your girlfriend with tears in her eyes. I mean, come on. And then, and it's like, no, it turns out that Pete essentially formed a buttercream branch in Chicago.
Yes.
So now we got a gang that's got multiple locations throughout the country now, which that's not usually a good sign. When you expand, it's not usually for good reasons. I don't know if Pete's got some angle he's working on where he's pretending good, but he's really doing bad underneath. But anyway, it says that he had a meeting with the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
Okay. Chicago, one of like the biggest cities in America.
Yes.
And he met with this teenage boy who founded a chapter of the Buttercream Gang in Chicago that apparently was so influential in that city that it warranted a meeting with the mayor and a picture being taken. And he's still wearing the same clothes he was wearing before.
I know.
And, it's like, and is, like,
is,
there
is,
you
is,
go.
Is this that's their chapter of the Buttercream's like uniform. So, and then after that, we do have a scene. We do have a final scene though, too, where it ends with Margaret insisting on being initiated as a Buttercreamer.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then the end, they all are, the four of them, her and what is it? Earthquake Eldon and Buzzcut Lanny and Sirius.
No Riz.
Yeah, Sirius Scott. And they're all rushing off to help the Widow Jenkins again.
Again, it's like, oh my fucking God. Like, I mean, like, something about this. Like,
somebody buy this woman a wheelchair or something, or a walker. I don't know what the fuck.
Or just call the goddamn fire department. I mean,
get her a live-in nurse, for Christ's sake.
I mean, yeah, instead of like doing the stupid bullshit of like coming over to her house occasionally and then like helping her up and buying groceries for her so you could buy a treat for yourself after with the change or whatever. But
and from a storytelling point of view here, the ending sucks.
It's terrible.
I'm glad he got, you know, he's started this buttercream gang in Chicago. Show us, don't tell us. This is a film, not a book.
So my whole thing with that too is, so Pete obviously had changed his ways over that year period where he wasn't writing any letters to Scott. So it wasn't just like the day the article came out, he started doing good things. He obviously started probably as soon as he.
Why didn't he write Scott before this to tell him?
That's what I'm saying. So it's like you're doing good shit, but you're not writing your friend back through the entire time.
Instead of having the town punking the asshole, like the kid, right. They should have had a scene where Pete calls Scott up on the phone, or Pete comes back to town and lets him know about what happened and shows him the newspaper article. My thing is, it's almost like Michael Weathered like quit the movie partway through and they had to like tie things up.
Yeah, that could have been it, actually.
That's what it felt like.
But that's the end, yeah. You know, yeah. Basically, Margaret basically says, hey, you know, we should make changes, let girls be in the game. And then she kisses Scott on the cheek to basically, like, you know, like, hey, you know, I kissed you on the cheek, therefore now you got to listen to me type of thing or whatever. I don't know. And then, you know, puppy love, you know, stuff like that. And Miss Jenkins apparently is just falling over. That's the other thing, too, it reminded me. So, I can't get over the weird thing about quoting commercials. That's the other thing, too. Like, the big thing was, like, did you see any new commercials in Chicago? Like, that was a big attraction. It's like, oh, we don't get the cool commercials that you get in Chicago. Like, okay, you know, I guess that was...
I'm pretty sure, like, you know, most of the cool commercials, like Pepsi commercials, air nationwide. I mean, he might have saw some cool commercials for like a local car dealership or something. I don't know what the fuck he would have seen that you can't see. And
I just don't know.
In whatever the fuck the town is that they're from. Anyways, that's the Buttercream Gang.
It is.
I will recommend, you know, after you watched this, which I'm sure you all did before listening to this. And if you haven't heard our previous episode about the Buttercream Gang, you know, in the secret of Treasure Mountain or whatever the fuck it is.
That's what it was.
Yeah, I can't believe I accidentally guessed the name of the movie. Yeah, if you haven't listened to that, be sure to watch that and listen to this. They're both on YouTube for free. So
yep.
You know, or if you want to, you can still go to the 4F's website and you can order yourself DVDs of these movies.
Yeah, you could go buy yourself a fucking copy of this. And
yeah, you know, which I recommend legally. Do that legally, you know.
Yes.
Help out a company that did things illegally.
The other thing too, someone had remastered this. The video we saw was a remastered version.
Yeah.
Of the act, like someone actually loved this movie so much. Maybe it was the 4F's that did it. I don't know. And they actually remastered it. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, there you go.
Good job. Anyways, you know, check that out and everything. Make sure you check out any of our other episodes that you might enjoy too, because we've got a big back catalog and you can listen to it here or on YouTube or anywhere else that you find your good old podcasts. Check out our TeePublic. I'm going to put up a new shirt in honor of this called the Buttercream Gangs of New York, or maybe I'll just call it the Buttercream Gangs of Chicago, and I'll do it in the style of the poster for the Gangs of New York. I'll think about it. We'll have a Buttercreamers shirt up on there for you. Sometime in the near future, if not when you're listening to this, shortly after. But you know, check that out, and you can help support the show by buying one of our TeePublic shirts. You can go to our Patreon and help us out there. Check out our social media. All the links for all of this are on all2real2.com, the best way to find out anything about us. You know, if you have any old, you know, favorite film that you watched as a kid that nobody else knows about that you might want us to cover, you know, send me a message at mike@cullenpark.com or somewhere on one of our social media accounts, you know, because I'm always up for finding some weird, you know, kids movie, you know, to cover on the podcast that I've never seen, or one that I have seen either. You know, if there's whatever, just let us know what your favorite, you know, your favorite little kids movie was, you know, whether it be something like The Sandlot or you know, I don't know what else, you know, Stand By Me or something like that, you know, whatever your favorite one was. My favorite kids movie was Flight of the Navigator. So, yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, just let us know. Maybe we'll cover that in the future, too. That one's an interesting one I think we should cover. Have you ever seen that one, Sesame?
Oh, I don't think so.
Oh, it's definitely something. Maybe we'll cover that in one of our next couple episodes. Any other final thoughts here before we wrap up this probably long episode?
Very long episode. Be good people. Be like a buttercreamer, you know? Mm-hmm. Churn that butter for the well. And
yep. I will tell you that this whole experience doing this episode has been a treat.
Yes, yes.
Remember that I love you. Sesame loves you. Don't go to Chicago.
No.
And until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to All Too Real 2 Podcast, a Cullen Park production. Produced and edited by Michael E. Cullen II. Music by Matthew Hawes. Subscribe and share the show. Visit us at cullenpark.com.